21. Gut over brains. On December 6, 2018, Rex Tillerson made his first extensive public remarks since being ousted as Secretary of State that spring. He was remarkably candid, fielding questions from Bob Schieffer of CBS News at a Houston event. Tillerson described the difference between transitioning from the highly disciplined, process-oriented ExxonMobil Corporation to the Trump White House. He described Trump as a man who is pretty undisciplined, doesn't like to read, doesn't read briefing reports, doesn't like to get into the details of a lot of things, but rather just kind of said, "Look, this is what I believe, and you can try to convince me otherwise, but most of the time, you're not going to do that." When Schieffer asked how his relationship with Trump went off the rails, Tillerson said, "We are starkly different in our styles. We did not have a common value system. I'll just be blunt about that." And so often the president would say, "Well, here's what I want to do, and here's how I want to do it." And I had to say to him, "Mr. President, I understand what you want to do, but you can't do it that way. It violates the law. It violates the treaty." Never one to let a slight go unaddressed, Trump slammed Tillerson. He cast the man who rose from civil engineer to chief executive at one of the world's largest companies and who considered himself a student of history as, of all things, unintelligent. Trump tweeted that Tillerson didn't have the mental capacity needed. He was dumb as a rock, and I couldn't get rid of him fast enough. He was lazy as hell. The insult was a reminder to all who served in the administration that loyalty was a one-way street. An honest reflection like the one Tillerson gave Schieffer after more than a year of service in government could easily be interpreted by the president as a personal betrayal from which there could be no complete recovery. Tillerson was entirely unbothered, confiding to friends there was nothing to learn or gain by taking Trump's bait. "Don't ask me," he would say to associates with a chuckle months later. "I'm dumb as a rock." The first week of December, Trump was focused on selecting a new attorney general. Finally, he could have a loyal foot soldier helming the Justice Department. He considered a range of candidates, but kept gravitating toward Bill Barr, 68, a well-respected Republican lawyer who held the job a quarter century earlier, during the George H.W. Bush administration. Barr was a favorite of Trump's legal team and close to Pat Cipollone, the new White House counsel. Emmett Flood, the White House lawyer dealing with Robert Mueller's investigation, helped sell Barr to the president as the gold standard. Trump did not really know Barr, but Flood argued that he could be trusted to be a grown-up and, importantly, had the pedigree to make him totally unimpeachable on Capitol Hill. Barr at first resisted entreaties to become attorney general again, but eventually warmed to the idea. Trump also considered Chris Christie for the job and had a much greater level of comfort with the former New Jersey governor, who was a ruthless political brawler and had proven his loyalty as Trump's campaign trail sidekick. As he angled to be attorney general, Christie played up their long relationship and sowed doubts about Barr. "I cannot believe you're going into a reelect with an attorney general you don't know," he told Trump. Christie assumed that Barr, a fixture in Washington's legal community, would be more loyal to the American Bar Association than to the president. "If he has to choose between the ABA crowd and you in terms of who he's going to make happy, he's picking the ABA crowd every day of the week," Christie told Trump. "It's just who he is. It's where he's from, and it's who he's going back to." But Barr had already signaled his loyalty to Trump in a 19-page unsolicited private memo to the Justice Department on June 8, 2018. He had originally intended to share his thoughts on the Mueller investigation in an opinion column, but Barr was so verbose, he figured the better vehicle would be a memo, which he addressed to Rod Rosenstein, who oversaw the Russia probe, and Assistant Attorney General Stephen Engel, who ran the Office of Legal Counsel. Barr sent Flood a courtesy copy. Barr authored the memo as a former official deeply concerned with the institutions of the presidency and the Department of Justice, and said he hoped that his views may be useful. In the memo, Barr denounced Mueller's obstruction of justice inquiry by arguing that in most of the publicly known episodes, the president had acted within his broad executive authority, and that probing his actions in those cases as possible obstruction was grossly irresponsible. A student of constitutional law who had once overseen the OLC, the government's premier legal office, Barr believed prosecutors could not question any president's unfettered power to remove his subordinates. Any inquiry into the president's firing of Comey and wish to remove Sessions struck Barr as ridiculous. Mueller should not be permitted to demand that the president submit to interrogation about alleged obstruction, Barr wrote. Apart from whether Mueller has a strong enough factual basis for doing so, Mueller's obstruction theory is fatally misconceived. As I understand it, his theory is premised on a novel and legally insupportable reading of the law. Barr went on to warn about the special counsel's indulging in the fancies by overly zealous prosecutors, and wrote that investigating the president's discretionary actions would have potentially disastrous implications for the executive branch as a whole. I know you will agree that if a DOJ investigation is going to take down a democratically elected president, it is imperative to the health of our system and to our national cohesion that any claim of wrongdoing is solidly based on evidence of a real crime, not a debatable one, Barr wrote. On December 7th, Trump called Barr to say he was ready to nominate him as Attorney General. Barr's youngest daughter was getting married the next day, so he was preoccupied. But Trump wanted to share the news right away. I'm going to go out to the helicopter and announce it, Trump told Barr. Shortly thereafter, Trump strode onto the South Lawn and announced his intention to nominate Barr. He was my first choice since day one, Trump told reporters. Later that day, at a Justice Department event in Kansas City, Trump praised Barr for having demonstrated an unwavering adherence to the rule of law, which the people in this room like to hear. There is no one more capable or more qualified for this role. He deserves overwhelming bipartisan support. At the wedding reception the night of December 8th at the Willard Hotel, a couple of blocks from the White House, Barr's daughter Meg said in her remarks, "Pop, you're the only guy I know who would upstage his daughter's wedding." When it came time for him to deliver the father of the bride toast, Barr said, "Meg, look at it this way. Just before the name Barr is being dragged through the mud, you are changing yours to McGahee." At the same time that Trump was heralding Barr, he was cutting ties with John Kelly. Trump complained more and more to friends about Kelly, arguing the retired Marine Corps general sometimes acted as if he had been elected president. "He didn't have the guts to work for the job like I did," Trump vented to at least one confidant. This kind of mockery by the headstrong president signaled an aide's end was near. Trump also started telling other aides not to bother keeping Kelly abreast of important developments, effectively cutting the chief of staff out of decisions in the White House that he had once commanded with military precision. This frustrated Kelly, who, after his decades of service in the U.S. Marines, had little tolerance for being disrespected or marginalized. More dangerous, however, was the fact that Trump was no longer heeding Kelly's advice on matters of national security. In the week after returning from Paris in mid-November, Trump agitated to withdraw U.S. forces from the wars in Afghanistan and Syria, as well as bases in South Korea. He talked openly about pulling out of NATO. Meanwhile, Ivanka and Jared Kushner, as well as a pair of ambitious aides who were eyeing Kelly's job, Nick Ayers, Chief of Staff to Vice President Pence, and Mick Mulvaney, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, were telling Trump that he needed to change chiefs. Ayers had been open with Kelly, telling him he wanted to succeed him when Kelly decided it was time to go. Mulvaney was less so. They reinforced their own selling points. Kelly had his strengths, but Trump needed a more politically savvy chief of staff as he prepared to run for re-election and deal with a divided Congress. On December 7th, after returning from Kansas City, Trump and Kelly met privately and decided to part ways. The next day, as Trump left the White House to attend the Army versus Navy football game in Philadelphia, he stopped on the South Lawn to tell reporters, "John Kelly will be leaving. I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy." The announcement was anticlimactic, considering tensions between the two men had long ago spilled into the press. Still, Trump afforded Kelly a graceful exit compared with how he had dismissed Tillerson, Reince Priebus, H.R. McMaster, and other senior advisors. Trump settled on Ayers as Kelly's replacement. The 36-year-old was a smooth and slick political operative, a wunderkind when he ran the Republican Governors Association in his 20s. Through his position as Pence's chief, Ayers had regular access to Trump and cultivated an easy rapport with the president. He also aligned himself with Ivanka and Kushner, who were enthusiastic boosters of his. But when Trump offered him the job, Ayers shocked the president by turning him down. He was unwilling to commit to Trump's request that he serve for 2 years through the 2020 election. A father of triplets, Ayers would agree to do the job only on an interim basis for a few months because he had plans to relocate his family to his home state of Georgia. While family concerns were his stated reason for bowing out, Ayers confided to some in the White House he had been concerned watching how frequently the president bypassed or ignored a person as serious and respected as Kelly. By leaving, Ayers also dodged inquiries into his work as a political consultant, for which he reported amassing a net worth of $12.8 million to $54.8 million before he had become Pence's chief of staff. Trump, who for days had been telling friends that Ayers would be his next chief, was suddenly a red-faced groom left at the altar. It was a humiliating blow for a president who loathes humiliations. Trump had no plan B and would scramble in the days ahead to recruit other candidates. On December 11th, Trump got his first taste of divided government. 2 years of operating without a check on his power came to a crashing halt as the combustible president met for the first time since the midterm elections with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. The leaders faced a December 22nd deadline to pass a government spending bill or face a shutdown, and they were at a stalemate over Trump's demand for it to include $5.7 billion to construct his long-promised border wall. But the meeting was about more than federal appropriations. It would establish the post-election power dynamic in Washington. White House advisors knew the stakes were high, so they tried to prepare Trump. Kelly, who had stayed on as chief of staff through the end of the month, and Legislative Affairs Director Shahira Knight, among others, implored Trump to strive for a deal, but to be guarded with the Democrats, who they warned might try to manipulate him. They cautioned Trump about the politics of a government shutdown and told him, no matter what happens, don't say anything that would make him own a government shutdown. don't take the bait, the president's aides told him. But Trump seemed to be only half listening to their advice. He wanted a dramatic clash on immigration with the Democrats. In his mind, immigration was his issue, a winning issue. After all, he figured, who wouldn't want a more secure border? As the Democrats arrived in the Oval, Pelosi tried to set the tone. She led a prayer about King Solomon. She and Schumer took seats on the soft cream couches while Trump and Pence sat in the yellow wingback chairs. The meeting was scheduled to be closed to the press, but Trump, as he often did, invited the press pool in to record the exchange. What followed were 17 minutes of raised voices, pointed fingers, and boorish interruptions, with each principal playing for the television audience. At one point, Trump suggested Pelosi couldn't share her true beliefs without hurting her bid to be elected House Speaker. Nancy's in a situation where it's not easy for her to talk right now, Trump said. Mr. President, Pelosi said, please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats who just won a big victory. Schumer baited Trump by reminding him that he had repeatedly threatened to shut down the government if he did not get his wall funding. Flustered, the president said, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. There it was. White House aides immediately felt a pit in their stomachs. Their boss had just handed the Democrats an unexpected gift. All that preparation was for naught. Trump got played. When Pelosi returned to the Capitol later that day, she recounted the highlights to some of her colleagues. She described the Oval Office meeting as being in a tinkle contest with a skunk. The speaker in waiting said debating the wall with Trump was like a manhood thing for him, as if manhood could ever be associated with him. Yet, as acrimonious as the meeting was, Trump was simultaneously on the cusp of a rare bipartisan accomplishment. The First Step Act, which would be signed into law on December 21st, represented the biggest overhaul to the nation's criminal justice system in a generation by reducing mandatory minimum sentences for some drug offenses and expanding programs such as job training designed to control the exploding federal prison population. The quiet force behind the criminal justice reform efforts had been Kushner, for whom the issue was deeply personal considering his father's incarceration. Kushner helped orchestrate a months-long lobbying campaign to unite tough-on-crime Republicans and liberal Democrats to reconsider sentencing laws. He had even invited the rapper Kanye West and the reality television star Kim Kardashian West, both criminal justice reform advocates, to the White House to help spotlight the issue. At Trump's Oval Office signing ceremony, Senator Mike Lee reflected on Kushner's persistence. I speak to Jared Kushner about 5 times a day, the Utah Republican said. In the middle of dinner, when my phone rings, my family says to me, it's Jared, isn't it? On December 12th, Trump called Christie with an urgent request. He asked his old friend if he could come down from New Jersey right away. They made plans to meet on December 13th at 5:30 p.m. in the White House residence. When Christie asked what was going on, Trump wouldn't tell him. But on the train down to Washington the afternoon of December 13th, Christie got a call from Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer and another old friend. Listen, Giuliani told Christie, he's going to offer you chief of staff tonight. He just got off the phone with me, Giuliani added, referring to Trump. He told me that that's the decision he's made. You're the best person in position for the reelect. You're the smartest politician. You can run the place. He needs you. Rudy, is Jared leaving? Christie asked. No, Giuliani said. Why the fuck am I going to take this job? Christie said. You guys are nuts. I'm not going in there and having Jared down the hall. As the train hurtled toward Union Station, Christie's mind was racing. If Trump really was about to offer him chief of staff, he had to figure out what to say. So he called Jim Baker, a legendary former White House chief of staff under both President Reagan and President George H.W. Bush. Christie knew Baker and relied on his sage advice. When he was Trump's transition chairman, Christie had spent 2 hours in Houston talking with Baker about staffing administrations. Baker picked up right away. Governor, he said, if you're calling me, you're about to be offered the worst fucking job in America. Christie asked what kinds of things he should request from the president. Baker went through a list of demands, including that he have walk-in privileges to the Oval Office, is able to attend any meeting in the White House that the president is in, chooses all staff, and that all staff report to him, other than family members, controls his own media appearances, and gets his own personal lawyer. Christie jotted down notes as he listened. If you take this, Baker told Christie, we have to come up with a new phrase that goes beyond patriot. Carrying a briefcase with his notes, Christie arrived at the White House and was whisked into the residence through a back entrance so he wouldn't be spotted. He met the president and Melania Trump in the yellow oval room upstairs. Downstairs, the staff was preparing for a holiday party later that evening, which the president and first lady were due to attend. The Trumps and Christie started talking about the chief of staff job right away. The only one of Baker's points that the president objected to was that Christie control his own media appearances. Christie told him, I'm not here to be your press spokesman. I'm here to be your chief of staff. But Trump insisted upon being the one to decide when Christie went on television. When Melania asked Christie how he intended to deal with Kushner and Ivanka, considering his famous tensions with the presidential son-in-law, the president interjected. Don't worry about that, Trump said. I'll handle that part of it. Sir, that is something to be concerned about, Christie said. Jared really doesn't have any problem with you, Trump said. Mr. President, please. This is ridiculous, Christie said. Don't worry about that, Trump insisted. Christie wanted to avoid giving the president an answer to his offer on the spot. He was looking to buy some time. And as they wrapped up their conversation, Trump told him, I know you. You're going to want to talk to Mary Pat about this. So go home and talk to Mary Pat, and I'll call you in the morning. But I want you here. Christie went straight to the train station to head home. By the time the Amtrak passed the Wilmington station, about 90 minutes into the ride, Christie saw a breaking news headline on his phone. Trump meets with Chris Christie to discuss chief of staff role. This was another scoop for Jonathan Swan, a White House reporter for Axios. Swan quoted a source familiar with the president's thinking as saying of Christie, he's tough, he's an attorney, he's politically savvy, and one of Trump's early supporters. Early the next morning, December 14th, Christie's phone rang. It was Kushner. He told Christie something along the lines of, I know the decision the president's made. I'm completely supportive. You and I can work together great. All the things in the past are things in the past. All the things that matter is getting the president reelected, and I know you're the best person to help us do that. I'm excited about you coming. Though Kushner reached out to Christie that morning and stood ready to work with him in the White House, He told associates that he did not recall this specific conversation. Later that morning, Ivanka called Mary Pat Christie. "Mother to mother, wife to wife, I know what your concerns must be," the presidential daughter said, pledging that no harm would come to Christie were he to take the job. "You don't have to worry about me saying, 'Oh, this is bad for the family, you can't go,'" Mary Pat told her. "This is Chris's career. If he wants to do it, I'm not going to stand in the way, but I'll give him the advice I think he needs to hear." "I hope that advice would be positive towards taking the job," Ivanka said. Mary Pat ended the call by saying that she would tell her husband what she felt was important for him to hear, and that her advice would stay between them. Mary Pat then said to Christie, "Listen, if you're going to take it, take it. But if you're going to say no, you better call him now, because these calls didn't happen by accident. With him, you never know. He could just tweet out that you're getting it, and then you're fucked if you don't want to take it." At his wife's urging, Christie called Trump. "It's just not the right time," he told the president. Christie explained that he had concerns about working with Kushner and that his memoir was set to be published the following month, which the world would soon learn was unsparing in its criticism of Trump's son-in-law. Trump was already frustrated by Ayers' rejection of the job and the resulting media narrative that no one wanted to be his chief of staff. So Christie proposed a face-saving way to bow out without embarrassing the president. "How about if I just tweet out that I'm withdrawing from consideration? That way I didn't say no to you," he asked. Trump liked that idea. "That will be a great story for us. You withdrawing from consideration," Trump said. "Like the Axios story last night. Wasn't that a great story?" "I wondered about that," Christie said. "It was just me, you, and Melania in the room, and I'm pretty sure nobody saw me coming in. So how'd that happen?" "Oh, I did it," Trump said. "Who did it for you?" Christie asked. No, I did it myself," Trump said. "I called Jonathan and told him." Christie thought to himself, "You're leaking yourself? And to think I came this close to being your chief of staff." But he held his tongue. "You're really not supposed to be doing that," Christie told Trump. "Ah," the president said playfully, "don't worry about it. He's a good kid." Trump told Christie he would go ahead and name Mulvaney a temporary chief of staff. "He's begging for the job," Trump said of Mulvaney. "So I'll make him the acting. He'll be fine with that. He'll take whatever I offer him. And then you and I, 6 months from now, you and I will revisit it." A few hours later, Trump named Mulvaney as his acting chief of staff, replacing a strict disciplinarian with a conservative hardliner eager to please the president at the dawn of a divided government. Mulvaney, 51, had long ago declared his loyalty to the president's family. He quietly campaigned for the job for months, once even vowing to Trump that if he were chief of staff, he would manage the staff, but not the president. But he never formally interviewed for the job. Mulvaney came into the Oval Office the afternoon of December 14th for a meeting about the budget showdown, and Trump offered it to him right then and there. The news was announced an hour or two later. On December 17th, Christie returned to the White House with his wife to attend a Christmas party for cabinet members and other administration officials. As soon as he walked in, he locked eyes with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. "Look at this. A ray of sunshine has entered the building," Mattis said. "To what do I owe that compliment, General?" Christie asked. They shook hands, and Mattis said, "Because you're smart enough not to get into the shit show." As he walked away, Christie said to Mary Pat, "There's someone who's not happy in their job." "Really not happy," Mary Pat said. In the first week of December, Mattis visited Ottawa for a meeting with a small group of coalition partners in the U.S.-led network to defeat ISIS worldwide, where he assured them the United States had their backs in the ISIS strongholds of Syria. By late 2018, the coalition's multi-pronged effort to liberate vast swaths of Syria from the grip of ISIS had been stunningly successful. America's secret weapon was a unique pairing: small teams of U.S. Special Forces, highly sophisticated in their training and surveillance capabilities, partnered with a comparatively large militia led by General Mazlum Abdi. Coalition forces provided air cover, and since Trump's arrival in 2017, the U.S. military provided the Kurdish forces with weaponry. In his early December meetings in Canada, Mattis assured his partners the United States would provide financial and military backing at least into 2020, per a policy vetted by the National Security Council and signed by John Bolton. Aboard his plane flying to Ottawa, Mattis told reporters that this remains a coalition effort, and added, "There's more work to be done. That hardened core means tough fighting there." Brett McGurk, the special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, had joined Mattis on the trip to help explain how the coalition needed to adapt to cut off ISIS's spread. On December 11th, McGurk gave a press briefing at the State Department to help spread the word of the U.S. commitment and the need to ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS. He seemed to dismiss the idea the United States would withdraw from Syria anytime soon. "We have obviously learned a lot of lessons in the past, so we know that once the physical space is defeated, we can't just pick up and leave," McGurk said. "So we're prepared to make sure that we do all we can to ensure this is enduring," he added. "Nobody is saying that ISIS is going to disappear. Nobody is that naive." But on December 14th, a single phone call between Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan undid those plans. On the phone with Trump, Erdogan beat a familiar drum. Why did the United States have to keep arming Kurdish fighters to fight ISIS? And why did Trump need 2,000 U.S. military personnel in Syria if they were close to triumphing over the caliphate? Erdogan argued that his forces could ensure ISIS didn't creep back to power, and that they didn't need the Kurds, an enemy of the Turkish regime. "You know what? It's yours," Trump told Erdogan. "I'm leaving." One senior administration official summed up the sentiment. Trump was like, "You want that pile of dirt, Erdogan? Fine." Without thinking it through or conferring with any of his government's many experts on the region, Trump effectively condemned a tireless partner of the U.S. military, the Kurdish General Mazlum Abdi, to death. Kelly called Kevin Sweeney, Mattis's chief of staff, to let him know what Trump had just done. "He told Erdogan we're pulling out of Syria," Kelly said. Sweeney knew this spelled disaster. Words failed him at first. He exhaled. "Fuck!" On December 17th, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo alerted McGurk and a handful of senior State Department leaders that he needed them to join him in an important call. McGurk was stunned when Pompeo told him there had been a change of plans about Syria. Pulling out meant withdrawing the 2,000 troops and an estimated 2,000 more special forces currently there, as well as turning off the spigot of money and intelligence. The size of the U.S. military footprint in Syria was a pittance compared with the local coalition force, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which had 60,000 Arab, Kurdish, and other fighters trying to regain towns from ISIS control. In the most active years of their partnership, The SDF estimated it lost 11,000 fighters in Syria, while the United States had lost fewer than 24. Just before 9:30 a.m. on December 19th, Trump announced the U.S. withdrawal from Syria as if it were a triumph. "We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency," he wrote. Trump also posted a short video on Twitter in which he stood in the Rose Garden and looked skyward to the fallen U.S. soldiers and declared that they, too, would want the United States to withdraw from its battle against ISIS. "Our boys, our young women, our men, they're all coming back, and they're coming back now," Trump said. Trump's announcement drew immediate criticism from Republicans as well as Democrats. Sarah Sanders called over to Mattis's office asking if the Pentagon would be sending any military brass or spokespeople out for media hits to discuss the value of withdrawing from Syria. Dana White, Mattis's communications chief, checked with Sweeney. "No one is going out," Sweeney told White. "You can go back and tell her that this was a White House decision. So help her, but no one in this department is going out to represent this decision." White called Sanders back with the bad news. "Sarah, we're not putting anyone out," White explained. "This was a decision that was not made here. I'll send you everything. We'll help you make your case. The caliphate used to be the size of California. Now it's 98% gone. That's all I can do. Nobody here is going out." "No one?" Sanders asked. "No," White explained. "I'm sorry." Mattis was genuinely distraught. He believed it was wrong for America to abandon its Kurdish allies, and he worried that the president's sudden tweet announcing the U.S. withdrawal would put troops in greater danger than if they had stayed the course. "He began to feel like he was becoming complicit," recalled one of the secretary's confidants. "Sending the troops to the border was obviously a no-no and inappropriate, especially based on the circumstances at hand. That began to chip away at his feelings of being a patriot. And then the Syria thing. We were 6 weeks away from annihilating these guys, and then he just tweeted it out. That was devastating." The Pentagon's leaders, still licking their wounds, had more serious work to do than help the White House generate sound bites defending the president. At 2 p.m. on December 20th, Mattis's Assistant Secretary for Policy, John C. Rood, led a meeting about the practicalities of pulling out. McGurk, the premier expert on the ground, had canceled his trip to Jordan and flown back to the States the previous night to help, gotten up that morning after a few hours of sleep, thrown on a suit without shaving, and arrived at the Pentagon for a slew of meetings. The military officials had so many questions crying out for decisions. How would they withdraw the troops? In what order? What was the time frame for stopping key elements of their work? Did they have to stop air support for fighters on the ground immediately, or could they continue for some time? If other coalition members wanted to continue working with the militia, what should the United States tell them? What advice or help should the United States give other allies that had joined the U.S.-led coalition who might be in harm's way? A central question nagged at everyone. How would they help protect the SDF and coalition members? Erdogan's Turkish fighters were reported to be massing at the border, waiting for U.S. forces to leave. Rood explained that they were getting some specific operational questions from General Mazlum. He had explained that ISIS was still a threat. But if the United States let the Turks rush into Syria from their northern border, Mazlum would have to redirect his fighters to the north to protect themselves. Around the table at the Pentagon were dejected faces. "We were all resigned to the fact that he was going to massacre the Kurds," one civilian official said of Erdogan. A question arose about whether the U.S. forces should technically reclaim the weapons they gave the SDF fighters. Some discussed whether the National Security Council should review and decide whether militia members kept or surrendered the weapons. Rood stepped in with a firm no. He said something to the effect of, "It's not our priority to take back certain weapons because this is too lethal for them. ISIS is not defeated. We are not taking them back." At that moment, McGurk had had it. He burst into the discussion with a fury. "Let's just be real, everybody," McGurk said. "Stop the wishful thinking. The president's ordered us to leave without a plan or any apparent thought. We're not picking up weapons on our way out. We can't get out safely without the Kurds. They protect our supply lines, convoys, and facilities. To say we'll take their weapons as we invite in the Turks is nuts. It will get Americans killed. The Kurds will be slaughtered from all sides." McGurk warned that because of the president's lack of planning, the odds were high that Kurds would be slaughtered. The SDF might crack apart. ISIS would rush back in to wreak havoc on the villages the United States and its partners had temporarily turned into peaceful havens. Nobody spoke up to dispute him or to counsel against the derisive way he was speaking about Trump. The military officers in the room looked resigned and defeated, as if mourning the loss of something sacred. Before and after the meeting, several talked privately in small clusters about Mattis, their rock. They wondered how he was going to handle this latest assault on a soldier's code, the military's duty to its brothers in arms. Trump had effectively forced Mattis to abandon a fellow warrior on the battlefield. "This is an abandonment of a partner and an ally in such a cavalier fashion," recalled one person who attended the meeting. "He had worked so hard to get us out of Syria and out of Afghanistan in a responsible way." This person added, "I remember thinking, I don't know how Mattis deals with this." They would all find out how Mattis would handle this in a few hours. The afternoon of December 20th, an aide showed Sweeney the video that Trump had posted on Twitter about our boys coming home and said, "SecDef should see this." It was about 3:30 p.m., and Mattis was fixing his tie in his office, getting ready to go to the White House for a 4 p.m. meeting with the president. At Sweeney's direction, he watched the video. He had no obvious facial reaction. "Huh," Mattis said. "Okay." Mattis had been in a pensive mood that day, with a lot of major events to ponder. He had been to a memorial service for a friend, commander of the 5th Fleet, who appeared to have killed himself. He left for the White House to meet with the president. Around 4:30 p.m., Sweeney called an emergency meeting of all of Mattis's senior staff, including Deputy Secretary Patrick Shanahan, Rood, and the other assistant secretaries, Ellen Lord, Robert Hood, and Michael Griffin. He passed out Mattis's resignation letter. There were long faces and expressions of shock. In the resignation letter, which Mattis had delivered to Trump, he offered no praise for the president, but rather laid out his own core beliefs. He wrote that America's strength is inextricably linked to the strength of our unique and comprehensive system of alliances and partnerships. And he wrote that we must be resolute and unambiguous in our approach to those countries whose strategic interests are increasingly in tension with ours, including Russia and China. "My views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about both malign actors and strategic competitors are strongly held and informed by over 4 decades of immersion in these issues," Mattis wrote. He added, Because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, I believe it is right for me to step down from my position. McGurk also resigned that day, which Trump would later dismiss as a nothing event. Mattis joined his team at the Pentagon conference room. He smiled warmly at them all, folded his arms on the back of his chair at the end of the table, and said, "Come on, guys. It's okay. All things have to come to an end. As long as the sergeants and corporals are on watch, it's fine." Mattis explained that he and the president had a good conversation and that he would stay on as defense secretary until February 28th to ensure a proper turnover. Mattis was light. He was reassuring. His emphasis was on the people who do the real work and how they would still be doing the real work no matter who the secretary was. Nobody asked any questions. One person who looked the most upset and shocked was Shanahan. He was indeed floored, later telling his deputies, "I always thought Mattis was going to run through the tape. This was his life." Shanahan didn't know at this point that he would succeed Mattis, but some believed they saw the deputy bracing for it. "There was a whole lot of fear in his eyes," recalled one person who was present. "He was going to have to shepherd this ship until whenever. The rest of us were like, the world is about to end."